My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Today's episode is presented by the Center for Global Development. The EU elections are fast approaching, and the results will have a major impact on global development. Tune in to CGD's special EU election podcast to learn why who is in power in Europe matters for people everywhere. Go to cgdev.org/EU podcast to listen now. That's cgdev.org/EU podcast.
So we've got these kind of stereotypes when we talk about far-right voters. You've got the like brown shirt, angry, neo-Nazi skinhead type. He's white, he's aggressive, he's angry, he's racist, he's a he. Got the small-town Catholic, driven by homophobia and climate denialism. You have sort of the British intellectual in a bow tie and a tweed jacket, talking about liberty and the decline of Western civilization at the hands of big government. A lot of us think about these people when we think of the hard right. But here's the thing. As we look at national elections in the lead up to the big European election coming in June, we're seeing that those stereotypes just don't cut it. It turns out that the far right is drawing from a much more complex and diverse pool of voters. So who really votes for the far right, and why? I'm Sarah Wheaton, host of EU Confidential. The polls ahead of the European election in June suggest that the far right surge could come with the help of young students, women, even immigrant voters. We've been hitting the streets to talk to them about it. And they seem a bit surprised about it themselves, but they say they're open to pitches from Portugal's Chega, Geert Wilders PVV in the Netherlands, or Marine Le Pen's National Rally in France. To get some perspective, we'll talk to political science professor Catherine DeVries. Her research focuses on this kind of fight for survival mentality. When education, housing, and healthcare seem to be in short supply, the fear of missing out can fuel the far right.
What political parties on the kind of, especially on the far right, have done, they're basically saying, I cannot pay for your hospital because I have to pay for quote unquote newcomers. We have a fiscal burden of immigration. We have to pay for other people and therefore we cannot pay for you.
But first, let's check in with my colleagues. Here in the studio, I'm joined by Hannah Cocolare, Politico's data reporter, as well as Aitor Hernandez Morales, our Iberian politics specialist. And joining us from Berlin is James Angelos, our Germany news editor. They were all recently dispatched to countries with a growing number of atypical far-right voters. Let's see what they found. Hannah, Aitor, James, thank you so much for joining me today. We are going to actually jump off from what's currently the working title of an article that Hannah is working on. That's this idea that far-right voters are not who you would expect necessarily. So, Hannah, broadly, you went to the Netherlands. You were trying to understand Geert Wilders' victory a bit. Tell us what you've learned.
Yeah, so the starting point was actually the Netherlands November election, and I saw the exit poll figures. And what stood out really was that far-right voters, there's this image of a far-right voter as an angry, old, white man who sits on his porch and shouts at people walking by. But then if you saw the exit poll figures, you saw basically that everyone had voted for Wilders. So his voter base was almost an exact reflection of Dutch society. The same number of women and men that Dutch society has had voted for Wilders, and every age bracket had voted for Wilders. So the conclusion appeared to be, you might think that you know a far-right voter, but it's everyone.
Really interesting. And I toured the last time we had you here on the podcast, you were talking about the surprisingly strong performance of the Chega party in Portugal. And Portugal's history means that in some ways we might just be surprised by any sort of right-wing surge. Can you just briefly walk us through that?
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting phenomenon because this year Portugal is celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Carnation Revolution, which was this military uprising that took place in 1974, where they overthrew the four-decade-long authoritarian Estado Novo regime. And the Portuguese people are really, really proud of this. They did a survey recently, and over half the population considers that it's the most important date in their 800-year history is the 25th of April, 1974. But paradoxically, you have this commemoration of this big fight against totalitarianism, and then this surge in voting for this far-right party that openly questions democratic rule. So it does create a weird conflict within the Portuguese people themselves. I was in Lisbon for the festivities, and people were openly talking about the fact that it was a very strange moment for them to both celebrate the revolution and also acknowledge that maybe its historic values are being forgotten. And that's especially important when we take into account the exit polls, because in Portugal, what we saw was that 25% of the people who voted for Chega were aged under 30. And so it does suggest that the party is gaining particular traction among youth voters. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the youth are disenchanted with the revolution, but it does show that there's broad dissatisfaction with the status quo. And Chega has been able to seize on this idea of itself as an alternative to the traditional parties.
Well, then that brings us to, James, an alternative for Germany. History also plays a big role in Germany's relationship to far-right parties, but we're seeing a surge for the AfD. What's your sense of what's going on?
The AfD has been, over the past few years, getting more popular in polls, even as they've grown more radical and more extreme. And the real sort of energy, if you want to put it that way, in the party has been among the more radical strongholds in the east of Germany. But it must be said that since the beginning of this year, the AfD has seen a slide in polls. And that began when there was a report by a local investigative outlet that uncovered a clandestine meeting between right-wing extremists and some participants from the AfD there. And they were discussing something they called remigration, which is basically deporting people who they view as including citizens who are not adequately assimilated in their estimation. So those reports unnerved a lot of people and they sparked huge protests. Since then, it's faced one sort of crisis after another, and it's seen polls. It was something at 23% at its peak last year. It seemed far-fetched previously that this party could actually ever take real power, but it didn't seem so far-fetched anymore all of a sudden. And people started to discuss, could we ban this party, put it under the watch of domestic intelligence agencies that are tasked with rooting out anti-constitutional groups? So Germany has these sort of abilities to use these measures to try and rein in a party like that. But then the question is, they've never had to use them before. You know, would they work? And this was the debate at the time.
So speaking of law enforcement, the party's lead candidate in the European elections is also coming under scrutiny as well.
So one of the scandals that has been affecting the AfD of late has been the allegations surrounding Maximilian Krach, the top candidate for the party in the upcoming European election. Krach's assistant was accused by authorities of being a spy for China. And earlier this week, as part of that investigation, ostensibly, Krah's offices were raided by police, as were those of his assistant. Krah himself is under a preliminary investigation inside Germany for allegedly having accepted payments from China and Russia. And now the question for the party is how they will deal with these allegations, how much it will continue to hurt their performance in polls. And they are keeping Krah as their top candidate, but they're also attempting to keep him out of the spotlight, and they want him to keep a low profile so this issue doesn't, as they say, damage their electoral campaigning.
And you just went to the town of Magdeburg for a big AfD rally, and were people freaking out about these charges against Krah?
No. I went to Magdeburg a few days after the allegations against Krah's assistant were made public. I went to a citizen dialogue, and there were a few AfD politicians, and there are supporters in sort of an events hall in Magdeburg. There were kind of a mostly older crowd in attendance, and they were sipping on beer and some soup, asparagus soup, and they were, you know, they listened to these opening comments. The first thing one of the AfD politicians said was, you know, we wish that Maximilian Krah was here, basically expressions of support, which got some audience applause. And then they went on to basically say that these allegations were part of the sort of grand conspiracy of the state and the media that are targeting the AfD members in order to foil the AfD's rise. If you were there, you were walking to sort of a parallel universe. Absolute distrust of the mainstream media. They receive their information about what's happening in Germany through these, you know, social media networks that have a skewed and very apocalyptic vision of what's happening in this country. If you were there, you would think that the, you know, the end is near.
And so what were the issues that people in the crowd were asking about?
They were concerned with their own, a range of issues in their worldview. Industry is leaving Germany because of climate policies. The country is about to go into a sort of terminal decline unless the AfD comes and saves it. That's one issue. They'll talk about anything as mundane as lowering taxes to being themselves the victims of a concerted persecution campaign. And so it's really a parallel world.
And is there anything else that you learned about what is driving AfD voters?
This anti-establishment fervor is what seems to me the main drive of support, at least among the core.
Mm-hmm. Hannah, Aitor, for either of you, do you hear echoes of that in the countries that you've been reporting from?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I went to Rotterdam to try and find people who had voted for Geert Wilders. That's the leader of the Freedom Party. It's a bit of a special party. There's only one member. It's him. So it was hard to find a rally or something. So I just basically went to Rotterdam and spoke to everyone I came across to ask them whether they had voted for him. And if so, why?
And that's a very intimidating type of reporting. I applaud you for doing it.
Yes, but I did come across quite a few people who had voted for him or not voted for him, but would have voted for him if they had voted, because there are also very many non-voters. The people I spoke to, however, they often said that things need to be done very differently from the way they have been done so far. And they considered him just the polar opposite of what has been done so far. And besides that, of course, they prioritized migration above all.
Aitor, migration is also driving some voters in Portugal, or not migration kind of in the asylum seeker sense, but an influx of new residents, and people perceive it as taking things that might be theirs, right?
Yeah, so in Portugal, it's a bit more nuanced. The migrants that are coming in, it's less a reaction of, oh gosh, these people are coming to take our jobs. They're doing mainly low-skilled either textile work, or they're working in the agricultural sector. So they are actually a very much needed workforce. The main issue is they're not being well integrated. So there are concerns about that, about how exactly people will fit into Portuguese society, given that it's historically been a country that's been so poor that it hasn't really been taking in migrants until now. What I would say, though, echoing the points that James and Hannah were making, is that the rise of support for the far right is generally driven by a broad unhappiness with the quality of life. One of the regions where the party grew the most in the Algarve, one of the routine complaints is that they have been asking for years for a new hospital, and it's been promised by successive administrations, and nothing happens. Their public services have really taken a hit, and meanwhile, housing prices have skyrocketed because the area is so popular among wealthy European retirees in particular. So you have this perfect storm of people who are being priced out of their traditional way of life. Simultaneously, what they view as what, you know, their villages or their cities traditionally look like is changing very rapidly. You have an influx of particularly Bangladeshi migrants, and you have a government in Lisbon who they feel has never taken the least bit of interest in them. So the vote for Chega is, I would say, less driven by any nostalgia for the dictatorship and more just absolute fury at the mainstream parties. And if you look at the exit polls, you see that reflected in the fact that all non-traditional parties actually enjoyed a pretty substantial boost in this election. It's just Chega got a little bit more.
And Hannah, you spoke to somebody who said a similar phenomenon was happening in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I spoke to a researcher who pointed out the same thing. So he identified several categories of voters for Wilders' party, and he says it's largely areas that used to vote conservative but are now shifting their votes to Wilders. And then there's poor areas as well, which used to vote socialist and now voted Wilders. And then there are also the areas, particularly areas very close to cities, who are kind of seeing the impact of the cities as they grow larger and grow, kind of bleed into the suburban areas around it, where they see more of the impact of city life, really, in their day-to-day life. And there is this fear, indeed, that rising costs are kind of making them drop down the societal ladder. So they see themselves as at risk of losing out. Also young people who, like I already mentioned, consistently raised the housing issue, which is also an issue that Wilders campaigned on. They said they have a terrible difficulty finding a house. They invariably tie that to immigrants.
Yeah, so Hannah, you talked to some people who specifically brought up this kind of migration housing link.
Yeah, so on the one side, there was this young guy. He'd cast his first ever vote last November, and it went to Wilders. And he insisted that he's not a racist. In fact, he repeatedly said that, faced with some of the statements that Wilders has made throughout the years, his gut reaction is, this is not my prime minister. I don't identify with this guy. But I do want the political elite to do something about the housing crisis. And I should get priority access to a house, not immigrants. Then there was also a young woman, single mother, who I spoke to. She said that despite being broken up with her partner for years now, she's still living with him because she hasn't managed to find a house with her kids. She was standing in a pretty residential area, and she pointed to the building blocks behind the square that we're standing on, and she said, all of those houses are being filled with asylum seekers. They all get state support. They get a house. I cannot get a house. And I've lived here all my life.
It's fascinating for me to hear that, because we hear very similar things in Portugal, despite the fact that, again, Portugal is a very poor country, and the idea that somehow migrants are coming in and taking up housing is, it's laughable. They can't afford the housing. Everyone's being priced out, but they're not being priced out by the migrants. They're being priced out by wealthy Northern Europeans buying properties in cities like Lisbon or in the Algarve.
James, back over to you.
I think the narrative of decline is key for all of these sort of movements, and whether that's economic decline, sort of cultural decline, demographic decline. I do think that, especially if you go to the ideologue of these movements and their core philosophies, it's all existential struggle, existential survival. In German terms, the Volk, as they would say, the people, are under attack from all of these larger forces, right? And that could be economic, but it could be other things too.
And there are some social issues that are sort of animating AfD rhetoric. Some things happening in kindergartens. I read in your article about masturbation rooms. What's going on?
One of the questions that also grabbed my attention that night, I was like, one woman stood up, a mother, she later told me she was a mother of eight. She expressed concern that kids today are learning nothing in schools. And this begins with the sexualization of our children and, you know, masturbation rooms in preschools. And I was like, whoa, what is this? I looked it up, and, you know, there was actually one incident in one school where there was some space that the preschool had set aside for children to sort of discover their own bodies. And it was immediately condemned by everyone, and this particular school took it away. But, you know, it's kind of, there will be this story or kernel of truth in something, and then it will be blown up into this sort of, again, apocalyptic, look, what's, our schools are just becoming rampant, places where their children are being sexualized. And this person believes these sort of alternative sources of information, that this is an acute existential threat, and sees it as a moral purpose to fight against it. And the AfD has, like, stated, you know, they will pick up that mantle. We're protecting our children against these sort of forces. They'll say, look what's happening to our country. Industry is leaving. The hordes of asylum seekers, their words, are coming into the borders. And look what our government is focusing on. They passed a law to make it easier to change your gender, which happened a few weeks ago. And that is the kind of message, if you have an immigration background from a society in which is more sort of socially conservative, you know, you might find that message appealing.
It's curious that it is an ongoing theme. It's people who see their society changing no longer particularly think that they fit into it, and they're worried. They're worried about being left behind. And so they're turning to alternatives that may not even necessarily match their ideology, but certainly match their frustration with the existing system.
This has been a super varied conversation. I want to end with Hannah bringing things close to home here in Belgium. We also have federal elections in Belgium in June, and the Vlaams Belang, a Flemish interest party, maybe kind of equivalent to some of these other far-right parties that we've been talking about, they're expected to do pretty well, right?
They are expected to do very well, yes. Particularly if you add that up to the Flemish nationalists of the NVA, together they could get close to majority in Flanders. They have been looking at the Netherlands with interest, of course. They do identify with some of what Wilders says, not everything. Their campaign slogan is also quite similar, you know, it's not Belgians, Flemish people first, just like Wilders' campaign was Dutch people again on number one. And if you look at people who think they might vote for him, one thing has stood out, and that's also that young people again are likely to vote for them, but not young people as a whole, mostly young men in the youngest age bracket, where I think about 30% of young men said they were likely to vote Flemish interest, compared with less than 10% of young women.
I mean, we've been talking about how sometimes these votes defy our expectations, but I mean, in some ways, what you're saying, Hannah, reminds me of just sort of the skinhead archetype, the angry white guy who takes some of his frustrations out politically on maybe minority groups. James, is there a sign that that is sort of a sentiment that AfD is drawing on?
The far right in Germany has gotten a lot better at packaging in recent years. And the skinhead look, you'll still see it out there, but it's not, you know, you will have somebody who looks like they belong in a coffee shop in Berlin, just doesn't look out of the ordinary in any way, who will espouse views and will say these things in a way that doesn't immediately come out at you as extreme, but then if you think about it, is just as extreme as ever. So the fact that they would appeal to younger voters isn't so far-fetched.
So I just wanted to add more broadly, the researchers that I spoke to were really keen on insisting that we as yet do not see evidence of Europe's youth going far right. They may vote like that in specific elections, but that has more to do with voting patterns versus ideology. The examples that they gave me was two trends. The first is what we saw in the Netherlands, and essentially if most of the population votes for a party, the youth will vote for that party too. They tend to not have a strong opinion, and so they'll follow the broader trend, and there's kind of a copycat effect. And then the second one is just the draw of a newer party. Basically, what these academics were urging was to just keep in mind that these trends need to be understood in much longer term perspectives, and that we should not necessarily think that, you know, all our kids are now fascists. A lot of them are just unhappy and dazzled by bright, shiny new things.
And just because the youth is more interested in non-traditional parties, these non-traditional parties tend to grow.
Yeah, it goes back to what we saw with the exit polls in Portugal. All non-traditional parties grew. Chega did particularly well because it knew how to communicate with the youth. So that meant using social media, using TikTok, using all these things that let them build that bond very, very quickly.
All right. Well, TikTok was one of the things on my list to talk about that we did not get to. So you'll have to tune in to a future episode of EU Confidential. But for now, Aitor, Hannah, James, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, we'll get some insight from Professor Catherine De Vries from Bocconi University in Milan. We're going to find out what centuries-old olive groves in Apulia have to do with the far right. Stay with us.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
A message from the Center for Global Development. Last year, EU institutions spent nearly $27 billion on aid. and stood at the forefront of decisions on support for Ukraine, migration policy, climate action, and more. Amid growing global crises, political will is urgently needed to turn development commitments into action. In June, EU citizens will choose the next parliament and determine the future of EU development policy. The polls are showing a potentially more fragmented parliament and a shift to the right. Could this slow development progress down? In a special edition of the CGD podcast, hear from EU development policy experts and current MEPs to learn why this election matters for development and what they'll prioritize if re-elected. Go to cgdev.org/EU podcast to listen now. That's cgdev.org/EU podcast.
I'm now joined by Catherine DeVries. You're a professor of political science and the dean of international affairs at Bocconi University in Milan. Thank you for joining us, Catherine.
Well, thank you for having me.
So one of the things that caught our eye when we were looking for someone to bring on to talk about what fuels the far right is a research project that you're working on. It's related to economic hardship and its relationship to political support there. Can you tell us a little more about it?
Yeah, so I think that what you saw, and I think that was also of the conversations from different European countries, is that actually the far right is getting a broader, let's say, profile among voters than we've seen in the past, where in the past it was kind of your angry white male, not to mean any offense, but that's usually the kind of profile that we saw.
There are angry white males in many of our lives who we love, so it's fine.
Actually. So now it's much broader. One element that we see is that actually people are increasingly concerned about the future. So it might actually be manifested economic hardship. We saw that, for example, in the kind of consequences of the war in Ukraine, that gas prices went up and that the cost of living crisis started in many European countries. But it's also the fear of that happening in your life. So it might not necessarily be that you're already kind of feeling that you're squeezed economically, but you just fear that that's going to happen in the future. So I think that's providing a breeding ground for far-right politicians that kind of preach, let's say, the politics of doom when it comes to the existing established elites are not really listening to you or taking your concerns seriously. So we would have to have a change, and we know how to kind of bring you more prosperity or bring back kind of the good old days where everything used to be better and more secure.
What you just said is making me think of sort of a definitional issue that we struggle with sometimes, even in our newsroom. You have populists, but not all populists are necessarily on the far right. And then you can also kind of have very conservative people who are or are not very economically conservative. So how would you kind of sort through some of these different movements?
So usually the way we think about populist parties, and as you rightfully say, they can ideologically be on the left or on the right. What kind of unites these two types of parties, you know, like now what we see Le Pen in France or Geert Wilders in my own country of birth, I'm Dutch by origin. So I think what unites these populists on the left and the right is that they are anti-establishment. So they basically tell you that the existing elite is not really taking care of your needs. They are representing a people against an other, and there the other might change. So on the left, we often see that the other are, let's say, big banks, capitalists, think back to the kind of 99 versus 1%. But on the populist right, we often see that the other is an immigrant or is people who are from different ethnicities. And then what you're kind of talking about, well, is there then maybe the surge that we're seeing now ahead of the European parliamentary elections and in domestic politics is kind of the, let's say, far right doing well? And the way that we use the term far right as kind of academics is that it's a kind of umbrella term for these populist right parties. So they're kind of anti-immigrant and anti-establishment and have kind of a different style. But they could also include more extreme factions that actually might want to undermine democracy in the long run. And why we call it far right is that because many of these political parties have these different wings, and they're definitely not going to tell you ahead of the election that they might be kind of dismantling part of the political system or maybe wanting to kind of affect a judiciary like we've seen, of course, in Hungary or also recently in Poland. So, you know, that's why there's some conceptual, let's say, unclarity, and that has to do also with the kind of strategic
choices of these parties by trying to present themselves as a more normalized version than perhaps maybe extreme right parties in the past. And with extreme right, we usually mean parties that really kind of reject core aspects of democracy.
And how does the reality on the ground affect their campaigns?
So I think what's quite interesting that a lot of these parties, maybe with some exceptions, that would, for example, be Le Pen's party in France, actually are not that old. They're fairly recent. So these are not necessarily parties that have strong connections to the ground in the way that we would think that, you know, mainstream parties like Social Democrats or Christian Democrats would have. So what they often do is that they use a lot of, like, that's also their strength, using a lot of social media and garnering support. So then how do you do that? Well, often by using more extreme language, presenting a lot of issues as a crisis, that's a very effective narrative in order to garner kind of public interest. But it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody that votes for them is always hurting, as I was saying before. So it's sometimes it's not even that people are actually feeling economic hardship or actually feeling kind of threatened, but they just fear that that's going to happen in the future, or they fear that they're going to be have to kind of, let's say, pay for the climate transition or pay for Ukraine accession or these kind of things in the future. So I think what those parties do is that they often kind of are pretty able to mobilize fears and amplify them and connect the dots in people's minds and make it to, you know, what people might think is a coherent response to today's problems and today's uncertainty.
And another thing that we sort of grappled with and that we heard my colleagues who have gone out and talked to voters who are finding themselves sympathetic to far-right candidates is kind of questions of race. And we heard from several people basically say, I'm not racist, but I think these outsiders, these migrants are coming in and taking my housing. In another case, one of my colleagues even talked to somebody who is of mixed heritage. And she was like, I know it's kind of bad, but I really like Hirtvelders. Does your research kind of give us any insight into maybe people feeling guilty about their support for these parties?
Not maybe the guilty part, we would have to ask individuals, as your colleagues have already done, but I think what is really the case is that we have to be very careful to saying that all these people would score extremely high on some xenophobic scale. But what my research shows I've done in Italy, but also in the Netherlands, also in the UK, what we've seen actually in recent years, either through austerity or through the fact that we are kind of in Europe facing low growth economies that are aging and a lot of spending is going to pensions and healthcare, that there's less support for public services, key public services. So it could be public housing, could be public transport, it could be schooling, could be, you know, a lot of different things that people kind of face in their everyday lives. It could be the number of policemen on the street, etc. And what political parties on the kind of, especially on the far right, have done is they've kind of linked those two things together. So they're basically saying, I cannot pay for your hospital because I have to pay for quote unquote newcomers coming into the country. What they leave out is the entire story about immigrants actually, you know, being much more entrepreneurial and creating growth, etc. That's not part of their story, but their story is very much like, I can spend money only once. So I think that the current problems of where you're feeling that you are on a waiting list for a house, a waiting list for a hospital treatment, that you're not, you know, have to walk very far to your public transport connections, or the trains are not running very well, that is basically due to the fact that we have a fiscal burden of immigration. We have to pay for other people, and therefore we cannot pay for you. And that is not something that maybe is really in people's heads, but political parties really make that link. They connect the dots. And that might get people into a situation where they're actually quite receptive of messages like, Dutch people first. That was Geert-Wille's message, right? Or money should first come for natives. And then they think, oh, maybe that's not so good to kind of be supporting. But they are making these kind of links almost implicitly because they're, you know, seeing a lot of that rhetoric from the far right. And that's been a quite effective. I'm not going to make a normative judgment about that. But what I mean is in terms of strategically effective for the far right, a strategy in order to actually garner support among those that might not be traditionally people that would maybe vote for the far right when you would ask them straight up.
And another thing that we discussed in our panel with the reporters who were reporting on the streets is that in many of the elections that we've had recently, many outsider parties, whether they're on the left or the right, are doing well. Is there something that sort of tips whether a disaffected voter is going to flip left or right?
Your reporters are very right. So what we've really seen over the, let's say, last 30 years or so is that political center is weakening. So social democratic parties, Christian democratic parties, liberals that would command easily 80, 85% of the vote, let's say in the 1980s, are maybe commanding 50% of the vote now. So you're very right that like challenger parties, i.e. parties that have not traditionally been really successful in systems, are doing quite well in many European countries. And as you also say, they can be on the left and the right. So what we saw actually in the financial crisis, we saw quite a lot of emerging, especially in Southern Europe, of the left, kind of far left parties doing well. Now we're talking quite a lot about immigration, and that's been really kind of on top of mind. So I think one key factor is, what is the election about? So is the election about kind of the economy, or is it about immigration? But I think the more subtle element, and that's what we've really been seeing in recent years, and I think that gives a little bit of a, let's say, an edge for more kind of right-wing challengers, is that they're actually connecting those two things. So they're basically saying, like, in your life, you're not getting all these public services. Not means that you're like the poorest of the poorest, but you're not getting, you know, your fair share of government resources in some ways. You're kind of left behind, and they're linking that to immigration. And I think that works quite well, because then you get people who otherwise might have been more inclined to vote on the left to go to the right. I do think that we also should remember that, yeah, we see a far right turn, but we also see amongst many young people turn to much more green parties or more progressive parties when it comes to the climate.
So one thing that I find a little confusing or counterintuitive is, I mean, we've just been through a crazy 5 years. We've had this pandemic. We have a war right on Europe's border. People are really worried about the U.S. doing something crazy under Donald Trump. So I would think now a campaign that's promising stability would be appealing.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question, to be fair. That's, I've been asking myself that quite a lot. If you go back in history, that's what you often see, right? So like if there is a huge kind of event happening that and a crisis happening, that people will go actually back to the center, let's say, which would be these conservatives, social democrats and liberals. But in recent years, we've really seen that, and I think partly that is because we've seen a long legacy of populist parties telling a lot of people, including young people, that mainstream elites just, you know, are not any good and can't really deal with politics and with kind of governing very well, that actually these parties have been very effective at using crisis periods as a way to illustrate that a change would actually be good. So i.e. to not show themselves or not to sell themselves as a risky option, but actually at those that can be very effective at dealing with the crisis. So we've seen that, for example, in the way that migrant boats is seen as a crisis, and they're then the kind of crisis managers that could deal with it. We even saw it in COVID by kind of criticizing the way vaccines were working, you know, etc., and saying that this is the bad response. Another example of kind of my own research has been kind of a big plant-based epidemic that happened in the south of Italy. It's Xylella, which was a bacteria that was affecting olive trees. And in that period, actually, in a time where you would think that your way of living and your daily bread is being under threat, Italian voters in Puglia, in this this southern region of Italy, did not move back to the kind of government parties or the regional incumbent, but actually moved to the far right as a response. So in recent years, we actually have seen the opposite of what probably has been true for decades, that people are not swinging to the center or not to kind of, let's say, parties that have had government responsibility for a long time in crisis, but are really moving to something else. And I think part of the reason for that is that populism has been now so normalized that people are increasingly distrustful of governments being actually able to cope.
All right. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being here, Catherine DeVries.
Well, thank you, Sarah, so much for giving me the time.
Thanks for listening today as we unpacked the surprising motivations driving potential far-right voters. I just want to express particular appreciation for you lending us your ears during this long holiday weekend around much of Europe, and especially with the heavy competition that we're getting from the Eurovision Song Contest. And if you appreciate European politics as much as you appreciate European pop music, then we hope you'll follow EU Confidential on your favorite podcast app, where you can also rate us, or send us a message directly at podcast@politico.eu. Thanks to Christina Gonzalez, Politico's executive producer for audio, and to Deanna Sturris, our senior audio producer. I'm Sarah Wheaton. See you next week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.